Hi, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell, and also my single brain cell in my head is on my other guest today. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Jess. I'm Craig Campbell. I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games. I make games. Sometimes I don't want to GM them. Even the ones that I make. And so that's kind of a little hint. But anyway, we're here with our long, many time returning guest, Starshine. Hello, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me back. I'm John Starshine Scribbles. I'm a TTRPG designer. I make a lot of games which don't need a GM, some games that do, and I make a lot of other stuff.
Craig, let's jump right into it. What are we talking about today, since we've accidentally delayed several times now?
Right. We're talking about GM-less games, games that do not have a GM. Sometimes you will see people refer to these as GM-full games, which is just because the things that a GM would do in a more traditional game is often split amongst all the players, and they all get a chance to do kind of some of those little things, but nobody has to like take on the significant role of kind of doing all of the GM stuff. And games, GM-less games tend to be a little lighter, rules lighter, but that doesn't have to be the case. They do kind of skew that way. Unsurprisingly, we're going to kind of probably take more of a player and designer bent on this, because GM-less games, we don't really have a GM discussion about what do GMs do with this, other than maybe a GM finds themselves facilitating the game for players, but they also end up playing a character as well, because that's what everybody does in a GM-less game. So especially at conventions, you'll see somebody who facilitates the game for you at your table, but also then ends up playing a character, and they kind of teach you how to do all the stuff.
And I think that's actually quite important when you're running a GM-less game, is to keep in mind is that a lot of sort of traditional bigger RPGs have an unfortunate baked-in assumption that the GM will facilitate all the outside meta stuff, such as like bringing books, setting up tables, offering the space. When you're moving to a GM-less game, you probably do need to have a discussion about who is taking over the facilitator stuff, because it is quite helpful to have a singular person who can, or just know what people are doing. So like, hey, here's where we're meeting, here's what you need. And it's sometimes easy to just have a person whose job is to facilitate, even if they're not GMing or facilitating the game itself. They're just making sure that, you know, your friend Dave isn't turning up to the house on Thursday when the game is on Friday.
Yeah, I've always found that to be very interesting about GM-less games. My first ever GM-less game that I played was Fiasco, and there was a facilitator there, and obviously they were also playing the game with us, but, you know, in many of the hats that this person was wearing as facilitator were those hats that were traditionally worn by the GM, and that doesn't just include, like, getting all the logistics set up, like, here's the space, here's where we're playing, but also stuff like, hey, I know the rules and you might not. And I don't know, sometimes I feel like that's a little unfair for a GM-less game. We're supposed to be sharing all these responsibilities, and yet all of the actual responsibilities are often still falling on one person. As someone who believes in sharing the power and sharing the responsibilities in your little organizations, I wonder that, like, the first thing I think about when I'm playing GM-less game is, like, what can I also do to aid the facilitation of this game? Because I think, like, yes, maybe somebody is identified as in the role of a facilitator, even according to the game's rules, but it's a good opportunity to think about, like, what are you doing as another player? What is everyone doing together to make this game happen?
And seriously, one of the best things that you can do with the GM-less game, I always find, is if you are playing, even if you're not facilitating, do keep an eye on other players. If you see someone who is shyer, quieter, who isn't really getting the chance to shine, don't be afraid to sort of just be like, hey, don't bring them into the conversation by like, hey, do you have an idea for this? Or sometimes just off the side going, hey, did you want to do something there? I looked like you were going to speak and you didn't. It's okay if you don't want to, but at the same time, hey, I'm going to make sure you get heard. Because that is an unfortunate side effect with GM-less games, is that if you have a couple of big personalities there, they can quite easily, not even of their own fault, I'm not even saying it's like this is a problem, but it's very easy for like a couple of people to run away with the game, and then the quieter people may not get that chance. So just always keep an eye on them. Just be like, hey.
Yeah, because you don't have one person who is specifically assigned the role of, hey, let's make sure everybody's involved. You know, in a traditional game, as a player, you can do that too. Like if you notice and the GM doesn't, that like, hey, somebody's being awful quiet, they might feel like they're being kind of steamrolled. But definitely in a GM-less game, I think it's worth kind of everybody keeping track of all that. And I would say that the facilitator thing happens most often, or at least more regularly, if the game is relatively new to people, because it's still kind of a teaching, like somebody's going to teach you how to play the game. That's still the way we oftentimes do this. No, the three of us would not go out and read a game book and sit down and just start playing without there being somebody that's going to be kind of like making sure they really kind of know the game fairly well, or are ready to look things up and whatnot. But like once you, as a group, if you know the game very well, like there are plenty of people out there using Jess's example of Fiasco. There are plenty of people that know Fiasco well enough that they could just sit down and just play. And everybody knows exactly how the game works. Everybody knows every kind of how it needs to be kind of passed around the table. And you don't really need a facilitator. But early on, especially if you're new to GM-less games in general, or if you're, you know, you're just new to that particular GM-less game, it's useful to have somebody that's going to kind of take the reins a little bit until everybody gets comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, and the nice thing about Fiasco too, though, is that that problem we were talking about, sharing the spotlight, there is a mechanic built into the game that requires everybody to like talk. Like everyone has to say stuff. Everyone has to do stuff in the game. And if like, I would recommend, maybe if you are trying out a GM-less game for the first time, picking a game that has that built into it, to see how it goes when there is a little bit more structure. I still feel like despite the chaos of Fiasco, there's still quite a bit of structure in that game. I wouldn't necessarily call it, it's rules light in terms of like how you're doing stuff within your scenes, but the mechanics are there when it comes to determining where play is going and how things eventually resolve. And picking a game like that, I think, is important, just like being really conscious of that.
Yes, because one of those games that is, you realize when you play it, it's there aren't that many written rules, but they all work together in very complex little ways to push and pull. I always describe Fiasco as a magic trick, because the rules may be the left hand, but while you're doing that, the right hand of the rules is pulling you players without even sort of telling them, like, you're going this way and we're going to make sure this works. You will not notice it, but we are doing it.
Yeah, unfortunately, Fiasco existing has made it harder for the rest of us to show off our really cool GM-less games, because that game is so good. And in comparison to so many other GM-less games, they're just not, I'm not saying that they're not great, but the Fiasco does, like you are right, that it does, it pulls you exactly where it wants you to go.
Fiasco is the D&D of GM-less games. It's the one that more people have played, have heard of, kind of at least understand what it's about, even if they haven't played it.
Yeah.
In that respect, mechanically it's nothing like D&D,
but and business practice wise, as far as better,
as far as visibility and understanding of what it is. And I ran into that sort of thing exactly when with Die Laughing and its sister game Paper Sleep Terminated, where it's built on like a structure. The structure is built to pass the lead role around to people so that everybody gets involved and everybody plays like the lead character in a given scene regularly as it passes around the table, and everybody plays the director within the narrative meta element that is the fact that you're making a movie in the game, and so that gets passed around as well. So even if your character isn't directly involved in a scene or two, like two scenes in a row, it means that eventually it's coming around to you and you're going to have to be the lead character and you're going to have to be the director at some point.
I think that's the secret sauce of signing GM-less game. You give good reasons why seeding control is a good thing. Make sure that seeding control isn't just you're not in the game anymore. It's the old thing about, to bring up another famous game that's terrible, Monopoly. The big problem with Monopoly is that players can be in the game but helpless. They can't do anything. Where you don't want that in a GM-less game. even if you're off scene, you should be getting a benefit from it. There should be a reason for it. Making, you know, it could be, you know, you still get to come in, you still get to do things, you get a currency. Just make sure not doing something has a purpose.
In the coven of PS13, which is my most recent GMless game I've made, there is a mechanic in there where, yes, like the control, the main control of the ritual can change between the different witches, but you can also purposefully cede control by making certain choices or try to take over control if that's what you're interested in. So people who aren't as interested in taking the kind of a facilitator role in that end of every phase of play, they don't have to do that. They can take more of a backseat and just play in the daytime phase more. Although everyone does have to participate, but like that facilitation I put a mechanic in there so that if someone's more uncomfortable being the head witch and deciding what ritual everyone's going to do and telling everybody to shut up, they don't have to. And that's worked out every single time I've played it. The people who are either playing a character who is more outspoken or the actual outspoken people can fight for that role within the game. And it just makes it more, I don't know, it makes it a little bit more fluid, and no one's feelings are hurt because that's part of the game. At least when maybe people have gotten mad away from me.
there's been numerous riots you have sparked across the globe. But also, I don't think you need to make a game where it follows that pattern. You can do GMless games where it isn't there's a GM role that shifts. You can do all sorts of stuff to make sure to remove the need for a GM. So very recently, I did a game based on the thing called Mantageist, where basically every player is playing their own game and there is no GM, but when everyone shares their information with each other. So in that case, everyone is doing their own bit of GMing there, and how they influence each other is literally by reading each other's texts to slowly add to their own story. There is no passing of the role. You're all playing at the same time. You can do that. Removing the GM does not mean you need to replace it with a pseudo GM or a moving GM. You can just decide this has no GM at all.
I mean, there are... I know we had talked a little bit about solo games earlier accidentally. But I mean, a solo game is kind of the ultimate example of that. There's not a GM there. You are the only person playing the game. And that works out for you. I don't know, applying some similar principles, I think, might be useful for someone who may be more used to a solo game, applying some of those similar principles to designing or playing as a player in a GMless game. I don't know. I'm speaking off the top of my head for that one.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, you're not entirely off base there at all. And for those of you who are interested, we're going to talk about solo games very soon. Not in this episode, but very soon. With Die Laughing, speaking to Starshine's comment about if you're not involved, you should be rewarded in some way. It shouldn't kind of suck for you to just suddenly be out of the game or out of the action, as it were. In Die Laughing, it's built in such a way, like every character has a dice pool, and the slow reduction of that dice pool is the primary game mechanic in that game. And so when you run out of dice, your character dies. So if you are not in a scene, you can't have your dice pool reduced. There's literally character archetypes that you can play where one of your special abilities is to remove yourself from the scene. You're like, I don't want to be here. My character's going to like say, screw this noise and leave, or they're going to wander off or whatever, which prevents them from getting closer to death because they're not in the scene. Because in a horror movie or a space disaster movie, like, you don't generally want to see characters die off screen. You want the character to be in the scene so you can see the comedic death in the horror comedy or the big dramatic death in the space disaster movie. But you are limited in how much that can happen because the role of lead character is going to keep coming around, and that ability to remove yourself from the scene, if you have it for your character, is limited. So you can only save yourself for so long, but you do gain a benefit from not being in the scene. And you get to have that, you know, I get to sit back for a few minutes and just enjoy the show.
It prevents somebody from never actually getting to play the game, too. That would really, really suck. Like, oh, I'm sat here and then you killed my character off.
There's a
Why I
lot of
should just play a video game?
there's a lot of characters that are in the world of Die Laughing who never have a scene and they don't get killed by the monster, but they're not in the movie. They're like in the next town over or on the other side of the world. You're not playing those characters. You're playing the characters who are actually being stalked by the monster.
Ah, they die, but Dave has a lovely evening and a nice bottle of wine. It's just a generally nice time. I like that. Yeah, I also think we are coming back to with you mentioning Die Laughing is that one thing I think GM-less games need a bit more is they do need a nice, good elevator statement of genre. I always will bang on that genre, but without a GM or sort of a central force to sort of do all the. Because again, traditional games, they basically tell the GM, hey, build a whole world and deal with all the plot holes we've got in our core books. Fill them in for us, would you?
Hey, don't call
Yeah.
me out.
But having to know, so all players come in knowing what it is really good. So being able to say, this is a comedy slasher game, this is a game inspired by slapstick films of the 40s. So then all players know what they're coming into, and it gives them more freedom to world build by being able to tell them very quickly, here's sort of what you're expecting to do. You're setting boundaries in a very soft way. So, a player who gets put on the spot when they get a chance to control the scene doesn't randomly go, the mannequins all come alive. Okay. Like, it's giving that sort of bounding thing. It's good because it makes the game easy to follow, but it also helps players who are shyer because you tell someone name a dog and they're going to sort of panic, but say, hey, name a brown dog with green eyes, they'll probably be quicker because it's got that limit. You've cut off the infinite potential and reduced it into a very small thing that everyone kind of is vaguely familiar with the general tropes of.
That's
I thought that's a great point.
Yeah, that's something that I am a big believer in when it comes to particularly GM-less games, is because knowing the tropes of, as Starshine said, this very specific genre or this weird mashup of genres is helps everybody play that thing without having a GM to reinforce. Like, okay, this is high heroic fantasy, so everybody has to be doing heroic things, and I'm going to set out challenges that are going to force you to be heroic. Whereas if you're playing a GM-less game of that, everybody's looking. Or kind of improvising on their own, the big high heroic thing that they can have their character do. I've done that with both of my GM-less games. Like, there's literally a list of tropes in the back of the book. So if somebody doesn't know their horror movies inside and out, and they maybe know a few tropes from just having heard a little bit about, like 80s slasher movies, like there's a whole list of other stuff back there. So you can always just go back to that, be like, when in doubt, I'm gonna, have have the scene where the killer comes back to life when you think he's dead, or I'm gonna have the police show up and immediately get killed. Like, there's no help from outside authority figures. That's a common one for horror. For space disaster, there's gonna be, the dramatic speech that ultimately, like, right after that, the person dies or sacrifices themselves or something. So there's tropes that work into that. And like speaking to Fiasco with Jess, if you don't know Coen Brothers movies, and I think that that's probably the touchstone that a lot of people use for Fiasco, you could make a list of just the general tropes that Coen Brothers movies are all about. There's going to be like you have to end things probably worse than you started off. Unexpected death or unexpected, like, major turn of events that nobody saw coming. That happens in Coen Brothers movies all the time. And you could make that list. I don't remember off the top of my head if Fiasco has such a list in it, or the new version of Fiasco with cards has anything like that in it. But it's something that if you're prepping to play that game, and maybe people are like, well, I don't really know Coen Brothers movies. They don't want to spend like a weekend watching a dozen films. You could just make a list. Somebody who does know those tropes could just make a list and like, here's the things we want to look to do, and it's all going to be stuff that's going to cause like your character to just have everything go terribly wrong for them.
And even if you don't make the list, Fiasco does that enough to poke someone to Google. It gives you enough to go on that someone who has no idea what sort of Fiasco is can pretty quickly sort of get an idea of what sort of genres of films they should Google to look into to get a better idea of what the game is. It's again, it's one of the other Fiasco's great left hand, right hand tricks of it's giving you all the information. You don't think it is, but it is giving you a lot of information in that very short time.
The game that I'm currently developing, finishing developing, is Beach Episode, which is also GMless. And it does a lot of the same things. I mean, everyone knows what a beach episode is. I mean, and if you don't, you can figure it out pretty quickly. It's not that heavy of a genre. It's not even really a genre. But
if you've listened to this podcast, right, you have literally watched just tell me, Craig, what a beach episode is. Because when you say everybody knows what a beach episode is, I didn't, because I don't watch anime.
Oh, true.
But now you know.
But I get the shtick now, and I get how that idea. I've seen that in other TV shows where they have an episode where suddenly there's like, it's not about the central conflict and it's about personal, like this whole thing just takes a sidetrack and it's about personal relationships and coming to grips with some subplot rather than kind of propelling the story.
So the trick I'm trying to pull off with that game is that, like, sure, there's not really a genre that necessarily goes into this, but a trope, but to make up for that, you're playing characters that, I mean, the way that the game's designed is you're playing characters that you're already well established with, that you already know, like, their inner world, and you're trying to discover that a little bit more. You're trying to develop the team a little bit more, all the emotional things. So you don't need to necessarily have you don't need to focus on the story. You're just focusing on those characters that you already do know the limits and bounds with because you've been playing with them. That's the trick I'm trying to pull off. The one thing I'm worried about once it's in the hands of players is the GM of your game, because you're going to be taking characters from your game and you might have a GM in a very GM structured game. That GM is picking a character. They get to play an NPC as a player character for this game. I need to make sure that GM is not going to be the GM of the game if this GM-less game anymore. So, like, easing them into that, into this new role as a player, and kind of relinquishing control in an otherwise very controlled game that they might be in the middle of. I mean, I have my thoughts on how I'm going to do it, but I'm curious about what you guys are thinking.
I think there's lots of ways you could approach that. I think just sometimes, and this is the point I was going to bring on to, is that you can just say that directly. Have a note. Be like, hey, this is your chance to not do that. It's your chance to do something else. I think it's a personal bugbear of mine with GM-less games and some solo games, actually, is you can respect the people you're writing to.
Mm-hmm.
I know some of us give the impression of being idiots, and I am an idiot, but you can presume that your people playing your game are going to engage with it fairly. They're going to sort of give you the benefit of the doubt. I see a lot of, like, GM-less games lay out the minutia too much. Like, they really go in on, like, oh, if you do this, it's like you can step back. You don't have to account for players doing strange things. Like, it's a joke I have with my editor quite a lot. It's like, I can't put a rule in that tells someone to not throw the table out of the window. Whatever I write, if they want to throw a table, they're going to do that. There's no point in me having 101 caveats to play nicely, children. I can warn out safety tools, which I do, but you can be a bit more loose and sometimes just be direct. Be like, hey, this is what this game is. If you don't want to do that, you don't want to be in a situation where giving up control, this isn't really the game for you, and that's fine. Do whatever you want with your life.
Yeah,
it's fine to sometimes just have that openness and, you know, trust the players to engage with it as adults and as open beings with lived experience.
Thank goodness we're not like some strange alien Star Trek species that only can work with explicit rules. Thank goodness we as humans can understand implicitness and implicit rules and the social contract.
I do that sort of thing. I keep that in the forefront of my mind a lot when I'm designing. It's like, I trust the reader. I'm not going to tell you absolutely everything because I trust you to fill in the gaps. I'll give you what I feel is important and the rest is yours. And I've run into weird situations where, like, if I've hired a freelancer or have somebody that's I'm like bouncing ideas off of, and that person starts to put like way too much in, or they start to suggest things that are kind of beyond the scope of what the game is really supposed to be doing. You know, I have to just kind of sometimes remind people, it's like, that's great. I think that's great. And maybe it's right for a supplement, and maybe it's, or maybe it's right for a different game or whatever, but it's not part of this game. This game does this thing. And I think with GM-less games, that's, you know, that's something that can kind of be reiterated at the table when you're playing. So make sure everybody's kind of all on the same page when you're planning and getting ready to, you know, to play it. Y'all come in with like the plan in place. And if you're designing it and you're writing it, it's okay to just, you know, make it very like clear. Like this is the genre it is. I'm going to let you fill in the gaps. That's one of the reasons like Die Laughing, I think works as well as it does, because everybody knows, even if you don't watch a lot of horror movies, you know of horror movies and horror stories and this tropes of, you know, like the person who's being chased falls down. And what happens when that happens? What happens, you know, like if like, you know, all the little bits and pieces, the kind of cliches of it. So you can, I don't have to provide a bunch of explicit setting material. I didn't do that in either one of the games. Like if you're playing a game about space disasters, you probably know, you've probably seen at least a few space disaster movies. I don't need to give you a whole universe that this is set in. It's like, no, make that up as you go. What's important is that you're waking up for hypersleep. You're on a big ship in the middle of nowhere. No help is coming. And there's a threat. And that threat is described, but that's it. The rest of what's the ship look like? I don't care. Like, why would I limit you? Why would I limit the players by defining the ship?
You can pull off a lot too with like your art and your design of the game, very subtly, just like, oh, here, this, you let this influence you, let this inspire you.
The art, you know, plenty of art can be the art can be, you know, suggestions for things and inspirational. But I didn't do, you know, 10 pages of describing the details of this generational ship or this, you know, long voyage starship that you're on.
Yeah. Something else I kind of want to touch on is when we talk about, so a big thing you see in GM's games is stuff that allows you to take control of the world mechanics. There is one hole I would give to designers when working on that is to sort of just make sure you lay out what can and what cannot be changed via certain mechanics. I've definitely played in a couple of, for instance, Fate games where which have fallen apart because there is a difference between the GM and the players over what a compel can do. E.g., can a compel make you make a bad decision or a dunderheaded decision? For instance, one that always hits my head I saw was a friend of mine was playing in a game and their character was a risk taker. So the GM gave them a compel to jump off a building. It's like, well, that's not what a risk taker would do. That's just plainly stupid. Same if your GM's game gives players the ability to reshape the world, just make sort of what the lines are. E.g., you can't say gravity goes up now and entropy does not exist. That would be a bit silly. Or can you override what other players have previously said? You know, can you do sort of the genie in the bottle thing of undoing the other wish's wish by wishing the opposite back? Or is it a case of once it's established, it can't be changed? That is one of those little details that you don't even have to explicitly do it. Just make it clear. Like, this is the parameters of what this take control can do, this scene change can do. You have to have a whole list, but just, it changes, as I said, we're saying with the movie thing. It's like a movie. It changes the scene to the next one in a movie. Obviously, a horror movie isn't going to have a sudden musical number. That would be a bit odd. Unless it's
somebody hasn't watched the sequel to Slumber Party Massacre.
I have, but I knew you were going to say that. Okay.
Slumber Party Massacre 2, the Driller Killer has an extended musical number during the climax of the movie.
There's not going to be a can-can sequence, like a Bubsy, like 20s showgirl sequence is what I'm after. That's not going to happen in a... So you can just say, yeah, that's not something you're going to be able to do here, because why would you? In the same way as if a player says, I'm going to build this thing, your next move can't be to unwish it from existence, because then you end up at point zero where nothing is a thing anymore. And again, that's part trusting the players, but just making it clear. So a player who is new and is getting used to role-playing knows what their boundaries are. Because again, it's the improv thing. If you have to make something up from the infinites of existence, you're going to stuck. But if like, hey, you can do these things, it cuts them off and makes it much easier to come up with cool stuff.
Like I've actually Speaking to, like, you talked about, like, you know, not negating something that somebody else has established, not getting into an argument basically by saying, I say it's this way and somebody else says it's that way, is I've gone so far with a few of my really small, GMless games, like low stakes. I've gone into, you know, I've spent a page or two talking about the basic rules of improvisation, of, you know, like improvisational performance, which is, you know, and they, people say, yes, and, well, what does that really mean? It means, like, you accept what the person has said and then you build on top of it. And that, you know, driving that idea home. So that can be a useful thing to have in a GMless game, because you don't have the arbiter who's kind of reining people back in necessarily. Mm-hmm. Although safety tools can fit that, that role if it's hitting a topic that, you know, you're uncomfortable with. But with just general, like, it's useful to say, like, hey, remember, the rules of this game are, like, you no matter what somebody says, that's what's happening. and you build upon that and build from that, rather than doing something later that's going to negate that.
And you're right about the safety tools. Like, safety tools can be there as, like, a fail safe. I do, like, safety tools don't always have to be about, like, here's a topic we don't want to talk about in this game. Here's something that's making people feel uncomfortable. Safety, like, but you should maybe be inspired by how those safety tools interact. If you do have a game, specifically if you have a game where the players are going to be more adversarial with each other rather than cooperative, because some GMless games are much more cooperative, some are more adversarial. And there's no wrong or right with whether or not you're going to build a game on either side or both of the spectrums or all throughout them. But while Starshine said, like, you can't always caveat, you can't defenestrate your whatever, you should maybe still have a rule or a tool that prevents people from making a choice that is mean or is making the game less fun for everyone. I don't know what you would call, and I know that some games have stuff designed, like, within their guidelines, but just having something like that, not a safety tool, but a keep the fun tool. I still think that you should have, I think your safety tool should, like, stay kind of dedicated to the meta game, like the players, like the safety of the players themselves and their well-being. But also, like, within the game, because sometimes we do make silly choices. Or sometimes you might have a less mature player, maybe literally a child playing the game, and they need to be reined in some way. And if the game doesn't have that, you probably have some sort of interpersonal or maybe, like, an explicit protocol at your table. But I think that's something extra to think about if you have a sort of adversarial game where people are competing for resources or attention or whatever.
I think going with that early is also important. Like, knowing if your game is adversarial or not adversarial is very important. Like, it's one of the, because it will affect how your entire game is designed. And I've certainly played games where they set up to be cooperative, but you realize, well, we're all fighting over a limited resource, so why am I not going to start trying to make sure? So knowing that going in, like, I've written games where the entire point is to dick over the other players as hard as you can. Mm-hmm. And that's on the first page. Like, hey, you're going to be, this is a friendship ruiner of a game. But if you're going into this, you know that this whole thing is to, you're going to be horrible to each other. That's the point. But specifically those games, I make sure they are very fantastical. You're not going to be horrible for real world things. You're going to be horrible because you all, I don't know, want space dust. That's something. Yeah. Make sure you know that going in, if players are going to be. And then if you are going to have a game where they have zero, go all out. Have it early, but make sure that's the whole in the game. Make that the thrust. If you do want teamwork, be very careful to make sure that that's not a thing where players are going to be incentivized to be horrible.
And I think, you know, calling that part of safety tools is worthwhile too, because part of safety tools is, like, I showed up for a particular experience. We decided as a group that we're going to play this game and have a particular experience. And if something that someone is offering is skewing the game into a different experience, then it's worth, you know, bringing up and kind of making sure that we kind of steer the game back to what the group decide, you know, agreed upon for the purposes of the game. And that has nothing to, that has nothing, that doesn't even have anything to do with like whether there's like things that make you uncomfortable. It's just this is the game I want to play. Let's, when we've got so much freedom, let's not veer into something that's completely different from what we all kind of want to do. Like, this is going to be high fantasy, let's keep it high fantasy. Let's not suddenly turn it into a mystery.
I think to loop back on here to remember is with the old assumption, if you're coming in from older games, which do have the GM as the sort of meta facilitator, is that if you still need to do a session zero, and if you're doing that session zero, you need to set that up. You do not have that one person anymore who could manage all that. You need to have that discussion at the table and make sure everyone is involved. There are different ways of doing that. But you need to remember that, oh, right, we do not have our single person who we have been incentivized by the writing of the game to put all of the boring meta stuff onto. We all need to come forward for that and pick a system that works for your table, which could be, there's lots available. But just remember, because I think that's the thing I've seen with some GMs groups, is that they just forget because they don't have that person to be like, hey, we need to do this boring meta session. Like, I'm the person with the suit who's here to tell us we've got to do, got to eat our vegetables so we can have our pudding. So yeah, if you are in a GMs group and you want to help out, that's a good way to do. Just be there to be like, hey, actually, we should do this thing. We should make sure we have our safety tools ready. We should make sure we do our little talk beforehand.
And a session zero for something is, you know, for a simpler game, can be not even a, we call it session zero, but doesn't have to be a session. It can be like, here's 15 minutes up front where we're just going to make sure we're all on the same page. We're going to make sure we're not hitting on something that's going to make somebody want to quit or become angry with you or insulted. And then
the DVD menu.
Yeah. I found myself, it was interesting when you got talking about cooperative versus adversarial. I was in my mind, I'm trying to figure out like which one are my different GM-less games. And I suddenly, it occurs to me that Die Laughing and Hypersleep Terminated both, they can be either. They are both in and either. Because I've literally seen groups where everybody's got that dice pool, right? That's slowly whittling down. and when your dice are gone, your character dies. I've seen groups that, and you can like, players can cause other people to lose dice. Part of the mechanic is you choose who loses dice at certain times. So I've seen groups where everybody just kind of spreads that out and everybody slowly decreases in their dice pool until everybody starts dying really fast at the end. And I've seen other groups where one person gets down one or two dice early on and everybody just piles on. And it kind of does become adversarial. Like, we're going to get that character killed as quickly as possible. And then that person becomes a producer and just messes with the people that put them over the edge and got their character killed off. So it gets a little adversarial, but that's a social contract of the game. You got to see kind of where that's going to go.
I think
yeah,
a good example
it's set up.
That social contract thing to look into is Munchkin as a game, as a card game, because that has the problem of a game getting too adversarial to the point it feels like a meta problem. Because you will see one player just get constantly dived on every second and everyone's diving on them and it becomes unfun for that player because it feels like meta bullying as against two. It's not in-game joshing around where fun is happening. It's just not fun. That's what you're trying to avoid when we talk about sort of avoiding situations where adversarial games become meta annoying. Sure, you can all mess each other up, but it still should be fun for everyone involved. It's when it feels like, oh, I'm just being attacked now. Not in the game, just everybody hates me. That's what you're trying to avoid. And Munchkin, unfortunately, I'm not sure how kind ought to be designers, has that problem. It's a really good case to look into for how bigger Munchkin games can just become. Let's kick them until they die.
It's important to make sure that it's fun to lose in a game like that. Like, it's not fun to lose in Monopoly. You're sitting there and having to pay all of your money. That's not fun to lose, but it is fun to lose in, well, I'll use Die Laughing as an example. Your character dies and now you're the producer and you are unto a god now.
You are untouchable. you just mess with everything else.
This is sort of a side conversation, but what Die Laughing does well, and this is sort of the mark of a good board game with TTRPG, if you lose quickly. You don't lose access to mechanics, and when you die, you get something else to do. So, e.g., like, chess and Scrabble are great, because even if you're losing a million by a million points, or only have 2 pieces left, you still can do everything in the game, and you can, in theory, still win. Monopoly, you can easily end up in a situation where a player has just enough money that they can't leave the table, but not enough to interface with any of the game.
Yeah,
they can't buy houses. So that's horrible. That's a slow loss, and it's boring, and it feels awful. Die Laughing, you die pretty quickly, you have all the mechanics, and then you become a producer. Cool, you're still playing. You're still having fun.
I'll shout out my husband's favorite game, Cosmic Encounter, which has hidden roles that maybe you have been losing, quote-unquote, the entire game, but you've been meaning to lose all along, and now you've won. that's still a family ruiner, however.
In the classic Mario Party tradition.
Also Mario Party. Yes, believe it or not, my husband's favorite video game. He might not admit it, but I've never seen him more full of joy than when he's ruthlessly stealing a star. Maybe this dives into his psychology a little bit.
Freud was right. It's always Mario.
Do you two have any, we've talked about a couple GMless games. Do the two of you have any GMless games that you'd like to shout out for something unique or interesting that it does that a GM could be, not a GM, but a player could maybe want to try out, or a designer could maybe be inspired by? I know this is a hard question.
It's a hard question. Well, I mean, you know, I think definitely Fiasco is worth checking out. Magpie's first game was Last Best Hope, which is heavily influenced by the structure of Fiasco. But is about, and I've played it way back when, it's about, it's like Armageddon, the movie, as a role-playing game. It's like there's some terrible catastrophe happening, and the government or some organization or corporation or just a group of people get together. Here's this band of heroes that is going to save us. They are our last best hope. And it's going to kill a bunch of you in the process, like the characters who are going to die. But it's got mechanics built in there for even after your character is gone, you can flashback. So you have like your character can still be involved via flashback narrative. So that's a pretty fun little. It's been a long time since I played that. That was like I think I played that before Fiasco. Like shortly after it came out at Gen Con, whatever, 10 plus years ago. So that's one.
One I've been really enjoying recently, I'm having to look up the spelling. I believe it's pronounced Furimondo, Furimondo, which has GMless rules. It does a really good job of merging sort of traditional role-playing stuff with the GMless system. It's really nice. It's a really fun space game. I recommend it a lot as a sort of, if you're transitioning from sort of one of the traditional GM games to a GMless one, I really recommend it as a really nice introduction. Does a lot of things fun. It's a really fun pulpy sci-fi game. Reminds me a lot of Red Dwarf, which is always a good thing.
I have a couple. There's Alice is Missing is a very interesting game. It has a very unique mechanic in that it is played silently. It's also a GMless game. And I think it does a lot of the things that we've mentioned in the episode today really well. And then also Saltfish and Almanacs, which can be played solo or with a group of, I think, up to like four or something like that. And it's, you're not necessarily always playing together. Like your characters are not always together, which kind of allows you to avoid some of those pitfalls of those GMless games where you're not necessarily sharing scenes, you're not sharing all the resources. Both of those games I would recommend as like different lenses you can put on a GMless game. So if like you played Fiasco like me, I wasn't like a huge fan of playing of the game Fiasco. It's not like not the kind of experience I wanted to go for. But if I had stopped there, I might have thought like, oh, that's what a GMless game is like, and not have seen the other ways that people have experimented with it. So I would highly recommend expanding your horizons
if you enjoy world building. There's also Microscope, mm-hmm. Which is effectively it's half GMless game, half kind of world building sort of experiment. but it's all about kind of building you, the correct me if I'm wrong, I believe like the microscope terminology has to do with like zooming in and out of like the history of the world and the events of the world. So you're creating this whole little tapestry of a world or a region. A lot of people I know play that as a group before, or have done, you know, at some point have done this where they play a game of microscope before running a game, like an actual game. They create the world together with microscope.
Same thing with the Quiet Year. Is it the Quiet Year or a Quiet Year? One of those two, very similar. Very similar idea.
Unfortunately, A Quiet Year and Alice is Missing are both games I get names confused. So I always think it's Alice is Dead for some reason.
Yeah, me too, because Alice Isn't Dead is that really great podcast. And
That's it. There's also a game called Alice May Be Dead, which I also like, which is a video game.
Also a video game called Alice is Dead, which I've also played. It's a point and click.
Alice is just taking a beating. Like, poor Alice. Every time you turn around, there's just something terrible happening to Alice.
That's a stream we'll do in the future. A lot of Alice is one character that's getting repeatedly beaten. Can I just cycle around to a quick final thought?
Absolutely.
We mentioned Microscope. We mentioned what you were saying as well. We have been treating GM games and GMless games as a bit of a binary during this talk, just because it's easier to do that when we're having discussion. GMless games are not a monolith. There are hundreds of ways to do them. So don't think, because as you said, if you've tried one GMless game, you have not tried them all. I would recommend trying a few different ones, seeing how they feel. They all are mechanically vastly different. But if we broke them up into individual pieces, this would be 57 different episodes, all of which are quite short. So it's easy for this discussion. We've lumped them together just because it's easier to make a general point.
Mm-hmm. And this may be entirely just like made up in my head, but I feel like at conventions, if you manage to go to some conventions, if you find GMless games there, you're going to more often, with the exception of like one or two, like Fiasco, like the really popular ones, you're probably going to end up at a table with a fair number of people who they just don't get a chance to play GMless games because they have a campaign, you know, that they play in. And so you're going to be at a table likely with people who are new to the game too. So it's easier to not be intimidated. Drop into, like, you know, people who love a particular kind of well-known RPG, they go to a convention and they play that game because that's the game they love, and they just want to play it, other adventures and different characters and whatnot. But GMless games, I imagine, probably drag in a lot of people at conventions who are just like, I just want to try this out, and this is a perfect opportunity.
Yeah, that was my experience. You're also much more likely to play a game with the creator. I don't think that there's a lot of really big game studios, and by really big, I mean WotC's not making a GMless game, guys. This is our territory. This is what we do best as indie game designers. Wizards of the Coast could never. They could never give up power like that. So we're free here in this space. It's safe.
She says that, and now next year.
Oh, don't curse. Don't curse like that.
The monkey's paw just curled in on itself.
No.
And that was your last wish. You're stuck with it.
But I wanted a sandwich.
Starshine, thank you so much. Oh, I'm sorry. I have a terrible omen.
Just a sense of dread. It's going to be shown on, like, in 10 years, it's going to be shown, like, a red filter over it. Just like, yeah, and this was the moment the world ended.
Starshine, thank you so much for being on this episode with us.
Yes, thank you.
I always have a great time talking with you. You always have great insights and new things that I get to learn from you. And where can we all learn from you?
If you want to find me on the internet, I exist on the internet like a limpet on a ship. You can find my website, starshinescribbles.com. I'm also on Blue Sky, which is starshinescribbles.bluesky.social. It's a very long URL, isn't it? And if you're interested in more indie games, I run a site called Library of Words, libraryofwords.com, where basically every month I pick out as many new indie TTRPGs, specifically aiming to spotlight the games that wouldn't get spotlighted otherwise by bigger publications. And basically, if a game has no marketing budget, I'm interested in it. So yeah, if you want to find some, we've done a lot of GMless games there, a lot of solo stuff. Basically, if you're looking for new games, I'd really recommend giving it a look, because I ramble about games quite a lot.
You can find me also on Blue Sky. My at is Joska. bksy.social. You are right that those are very long, but I think if you just search Josca, you'll find it there.
Yes.
And when this episode is out, you will be able to, if you are so inclined, you would be able to support my bundle supporting the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, which is an important organization here in Illinois that assists with aid for immigrants and refugees in Illinois, in the greater Chicago area. I have a lot of great support, great designers who have offered their games to this bundle, and I'm so, so grateful for that. They will be an important organization for my city moving forward. You'll be able to find more information about that if you do see my blue sky. If you go there, I'll have a link there once it's launched.
And I'm at Nerdburger Craig on the Twitter, or not on the Twitters, on the Blue Sky. Fuck Twitter.
On the Blue Sky.
Nerdburgergames.com is the website, and you can find the games at DriveThruRPG. And also at DriveThruRPG right now is the California Wildlife Relief Bundle, as long as we're talking bundles. So if you go search on that, I'm sure you'll find it. It's a whole bunch of games pulled together. And the money from that will go to help the folks in California who have suffered from some pretty devastating wildfires. My game Capers is on there. So if you still don't have Capers, you can get it there for the same cost as it would cost you to get the PDF alone. You'll also get like 50 other game and game supplement PDFs.
Thank you to Avel Stefsax for our opening and closing theme song, which is Avel, licensed under Creative Commons. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you. We'll see you back here next time. Bye!
Bye!
What is going on with me today?
I don't know.